We sent you this letter of meat, and we try, you know, if you are a rabbi and you, you write to somebody a bill of divorce, or you marry somebody off, or your marriage is in divorce is legitimate, you know, all those kinds of things which have to do with being an Orthodox Jew, they become issues when Orthodoxy is redefined.
Yeah, but do you think that Orthodoxy is going to accept this new term?
There are people who will.
Yes.
Whatever they accepted,
the only reason to accept that is saying, oh, we don't need our principles and we can just do the halakha because we want to. It's just so that we don't have to do those halakhas which we don't want to. Otherwise, why would you accept those terms?
That's true. And many people use it as an excuse not to accept certain things. In other words, they'll say that certain things which seem to be part of Torah, not necessarily part of Torah.
That's your Islam philosophy, is do the halakha that are meaningful to you, and then well, those that are that you don't like or don't understand, don't do.
True. But that's what the Chiddush, which he thinks that you can have Reform philosophy with Orthodox halakha considered to be Orthodox. That's
it.
Yeah.
So, I just
want
to understand.
You have to go read his book. I heard it's a hot seller.
Yeah. The left-wing movement is saying that there's no godly backing behind the halakha.
You don't have to believe that there's godly backing.
Why would
you believe that? Why
don't you ever keep kosher? Yeah. There was no godly backing.
Keep your friend. Keep your friend. You can work with your friend.
Yeah. I said
he's wrong. No, I have
nothing. Why isn't he friendly? Even with Arabs. Isn't he friendly?
Yeah, isn't he?
What?
From like, there's
things that
we need
to kill. No, because I think he actually believes in things, but he's just saying other people don't have to
believe in
that.
So what? So
he's
not a good guy?
Well, this is... Yeah,
I understand. That's why we do a halakha without the backing. That's why so many reform people become bothered too. Is because they say, why are we doing this if there's no backing? And then they learn more. Like, if there's no God telling you what to do, why would you take on all these restrictions for that, you know, don't make any sense? Like, why?
Well, yeah,
you have to go back. If you're not,
you have to go back in time, really, to in order to understand this, really, way off topic. We have to go back in time in order to understand this, go back to Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn was a scholar of the 18th century, and he was an Orthodox Jew. But he did not believe that a person who kept for halakha, who's Jewish, received any more reward or would have any more spiritual benefit or accomplished more than a non-Jew who did not keep the mitzvot. In essence, what he says, Jews are burdened by having these mitzvahs, which they were given Mount Sinai, and they're stuck with them. But they don't give them any specific benefits or any superiority over the non-Jews who didn't receive these mitzvahs.
Kind of true.
What?
Sort of kind of true.
So the natural conclusion from that is that, you know, why bother? I mean, the only reason you was to bother in that case is because it's totally unfair. If you're a fair-minded person, you'll rebel against such a system in which there is no advantage to keeping these mitzvot over somebody who doesn't have to keep these mitzvot.
Right, that's the point.
I hire people and say, oh no, this shows my love for Hashem. I don't need rewards in order to do these.
Most people don't really love Hashem, and most people do things because they have to do them.
Reward and punishment.
Yeah, reward and punishment.
Right. So if you have to do it, you get the same level. It might not be fair, but you can't change the system. You're not God.
True. As a result of Moses Mendelssohn is considered to be, even though he himself was an Orthodox Jew, is considered to be the father of reform. Because if you undermine, and all of his kids converted to Catholicism, if you undermine Felix Mendelssohn, the famous composer, it's his grandson, who of course wasn't Jewish, if you undermine the concept of sanctity, which doesn't really exist if you don't believe that there's any specific spirituality which Jews accomplish more by doing mitzvot than those who don't have mitzvot, then it really becomes purposeless. Just becomes a meaningless ritual which has no real significance.
Right?
Isn't it? It's very dangerous. Well, it was very dangerous. And it's a very dangerous assault. Absolutely. That's what happened. What?
Mark
Shapiro.
It's the same thing.
It's a similar idea. Right.
It already exists.
Right. It's a similar idea. In other words, what it's basically asserting is that there is no benefit or no advantage to your system of belief. So therefore, you only keep halacha because it's a legal system which has been imposed upon you, right? Regardless of whether you have a system of belief or don't have a system of belief. But as you said, the natural result of that that at some point along the line, it just becomes a burden, and either you start tinkering with it, or you discard it altogether.
Why would you keep a law system that's not really imposed on you, because there is no punishment for it? You just keep the U.S. law system, that if you have that. If you didn't believe that there was anything to punish or reward you for what you're doing in mitzvahs, then just keep the national law.
So I'll tell you what he would say, although I'm not sure I can give you the email address. You can ask him if you want. But the, you go to the university's grand website and get his email address from there. But what he would say to you, I think, would be that even though the belief system is not required in order to be considered being Orthodox Jew, it does make sense. So therefore, at least on some level. So therefore, for example, reward and punishment is a logical construct, even if it's not required belief. So therefore, although it's not required you to be Orthodox Jew, when you die and come up to heaven, they will send you down to hell. You might not believe in that, but it'll happen anyway.
So you're saying it's true, but you're not required to believe in that to be an Orthodox Jew.
Exactly.
If you read the Shema, he said, I don't understand. If you read the Shema, once in his life, the Shema is very clear.
What did the Shema say?
The Shema doesn't say exactly that you have to know that if you do this, then everything will be okay, but if not, you have some problems.
You know, he says about this world, doesn't say about the world to come.
Okay,
I'm
that's
the one. No, okay, so he says, but it doesn't say you have to believe in it, it just says that this is what you have to do.
So he's basically leading Jews to because then you're taking, like, Reform, like, most of them are completely ignorant. So, you know, yeah, what's true is true, and when they get up there, they'll say, you know, oh, you didn't do this, but, you know, you didn't know, so it's not so bad, as bad. So, but if he's telling Orthodox Jews that the same philosophy, and these Orthodox Jews who do know right now that it's true, and then say, oh, I don't have to believe it, okay, I won't. And then they go up, and they're a lot worse off than a Reform Jew even going up, because the Reform Jew was ignorant, but the Orthodox Jew knew what was going on.
True, but from his perspective, he's broadening the parameters of Orthodoxy. Meaning you can have somebody who can buy into a Halachic system, even though he doesn't believe in the tenets which underlie it, and then you also become a loving Jew, an Orthodox Jew, a rabbi, you know, and do as he pleases to think of with
someone who likes to fast a lot.
it's
the same mentality as someone who wants to take on voluntary fasts every day.
Yeah, it's kind of anarchistic, right?
Yeah.
So that's true. nevertheless, there are people who want to
run cultural diversity.
Right. So the, from Mordecai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionism, it's an offshoot, actually, of conservative Judaism. Conservative Judaism is based on the assumption that halacha, initially, is based on the assumption that halacha is more flexible than the Orthodox would have it, because not all of it is divine, and
right.
It wasn't necessarily.
All itself is an interpretation. It's an interpretation of God.
Right. So therefore, it's flexible. Mordechai Kaplan took that a step further. He said, there is no God. But halacha is a nice thing because it's a cultural, it identifies Jewish culture throughout the ages and gives our civilization its unique character.
That's what Reconstructionism is?
So, that's how Reconstructionism is today. But that's what the original Reconstructionist philosophy was. So, in essence, you know, the Reconstructionists would keep the same halacha as an Orthodox Jew without the God behind it, right?
So that's what your friends tried.
So I'm going to tell us there is a God. It's just you don't believe in God. No, there's different. Mordechai Kaplan tells there was no God.
Okay.
The famous joke about Reconstructionism, in which the Reconstructionist model is there is no God and Mordechai Kaplan is his prophet. Islam. So what happened to Reconstructionism is that it became eventually, as it is today, a kind of convenient way to be a pagan within the confines of Judaism, or not on, within the contours of Judaism. And so Reconstructionists nowadays are very, generally speaking, touchy-feely, spiritual type people who actually like demons, because, you know, demons are these spiritual things, you know, they're kind of like similar to the witches who worship all these spiritual things which have to do with nature and so that.
So what's the difference between a Reconstructionist and a Reform?
No, they're pagan. They don't. The idea of God is subject to all sorts of machinations. I mean, they worship the They worship, you know, the trees. They worship the father, the mother, you know, the Baal. From Reconstructionist perspective, worshiping the Baal would be a very Jewish thing because we find in Jewish history that lots of Jews worship the Baal. So therefore, this is a Jewish cultural norm. And to,
I hope they all marry out.
Yeah, please go to Reconstructionist.
We don't really need them. But
yeah,
those are Jews that we kind of... It's okay if they marry out.
that's unfortunate. I mean, some of them are very spiritual. Some of them really, you know, they... But it's a self-generated spirituality. It's not generated by any specific, you know, guidelines which are received, but rather by them, for example, Shekhinah is a big thing. The divine presence, because Shekhinah is, you know, a feminine, so to speak, a feminine aspect of God. So that's very good, because, you know, it gives all sorts of possibilities for feminist type worship. So that actually is a big thing by Reconstructionists.
So what are renewal fees?
It's basically an alternate reconstruction. I mean, one of the major figures in the Reconstructionist movement in the later years, meaning after Mordechai Kaplan, is the Zalman Shachter. Zalman Shachter was a Lubavitcher Chassid, and he was one of the first shluchim of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who then went astray. And he became more of, again, as I say, a touchy-feely spiritual type guy. And he's an interesting fellow, because, like, when he went to meet the Dalai Lama, he went in full Hasidic regalia, with a strimal, with a bekasher, the whole business, even though he really doesn't, you know, he's not Hasid by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, he said he's the head of the Jewish contingent, going to meet the Dalai Lama, who's the head of the Buddhist contingent, and he'll dress accordingly. From that perspective, you know, you could incorporate, since you're Reconstructionist, you could incorporate a lot of Buddhist practices into your religious observance, and it would be fine, because, you know, whatever makes you feel spiritual and good about yourself is something which is inherently good from that perspective. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a specific Jewish origin. It can be even a pagan origin. It doesn't matter, because there's no intellectual definition or requirement of Judaism, it's only spiritual, and therefore whatever makes you feel more spiritual is good.
Exactly.
That's really the way to
look at it. Can anyone be, can non-Jew be a
renewal?
I mean, whatever.
Yeah,
feel Jewish about Jewish.
Because you're saying that it's all based
on Jewish,
which means that you don't have to be born Jewish to be a...
Of course not. There are no artifacts with conversion requirements in Jewish.
Okay.
Not that mitzvah or have a bris milah in order to be a Reconstructionist Jew. It doesn't work that way. So, yeah, it doesn't matter, really.
Is it
quite an offshoot
of that?
So,
what's their shtick?
What's their dominant
No, they're, I think that their main shtick is that they have watered down Kabbalah to the point that it is usable by people, even if they're not really fluent. And they have adopted all sorts of strange practices to make money, like selling Kabbalah water, holy water, and Kabbalah necklaces, and other types of things in which spiritual energy is infused, you know, Kabbalah t-shirts, if you go to the website, all those kind of stuff, which they believe channel Kabbalistic energy, regardless of whether you're actually from or not, but, you know, you wear the t-shirts, you're
not from books for a little bit.
Or Jewish, right, yeah.
I was starting to read one of the books from their center, and so I didn't know it was from their center that I bought, because it looked like an interesting book. I was 30 pages into it, just like, what? I did not know what they were talking about. Like, it was just, like, convoluted nonsense, it seemed like. I don't know what the heck they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have not read any of their books, but that's my understanding of the movement is that's what it's based on. My uncle, the prominent Lubavitch Chassid, his name is Emmanuel Shachek. He came out against the Kabbalah Center in Toronto, where they're very great, and he said it's a cult. And he was actually sued by them.
I heard it was a cult.
I think he won some lawsuit because he proved that it is a cult. So whatever that means, he proved that it's a cult type of organization. The definition of a cult is where there's one personality with whom, you know, if you're affiliated with that person, then you get, you know, all the spiritual benefits.
Well,
but
then
you
don't
by a lot of
every other Hasidic group would also
be. That's true. But the difference, I tell you, between Lubavitch and the cult, and a standard cult, then a standard cult, the understanding is that you don't accept the cult's leader and the cult's doctrines, you have no way of achieving salvation. Lubavitch actually believes that you can accomplish salvation even though you're not a Lubavitcher. Right? Now you get much more salvation perhaps if you're a Lubavitcher. So you'll accomplish salvation even if you are not a Lubavitcher. So that is a, there's still that, what's the word looking for? That broad-minded, that they're willing to accept
absolute
salvation without
all birth. Citizens, different groups. See, they have the Rebbe, and they connect spiritually through him, and that's how...
Right, I was going to say, most Hasidic groups don't believe that their Rebbe is the only way by which one can accomplish optimum salvation. Whereas Lubavitcher believes that their Rebbe is the only way which one, through which one can achieve optimum salvation, although one can achieve it in other ways as well. Okay, well, the question is, what is optimum, you know, Rabbi Helder Moshe Feinstein was a great tzaddik and a great tzaddik, and he showed a lot of deference and respect, so clearly he doesn't have to be a Lubavitcher in order to be a great
tzaddik. I heard in the Kabbalah channel, like, there's some Orthodox rabbis that are really part of that.
Actually, I think all the rabbis are Orthodox.
Yeah, I met the head of it. He walks around wearing a Yom Kippur.
Yeah, officially they're all Orthodox. They're not claimed to be non-Orthodox. So the rabbis, what they're managed to do is to divorce Kabbalah, the concept of Kabbalistic energy, from the concept of halachic Judaism, which is, of course, a misapplication of Kabbalah. Kabbalah is something which functions within the halachic system and only works if you keep Torah and mitzvot the right way. But therefore, their philosophy, what they're trying to spread is the philosophy that Kabbalah is like magic, and therefore works regardless of whether you buy into the entire system or not. That's their main
book. There's an Orthodox rabbi who wrote this book, and he's saying some very interesting things that, like, the way most people pray is he considered idol worship, because he said no one has the proper intent. And therefore, when people pray, it's meaningless, and it actually angers God. And like I said, like, the real way to do it is to, you know, sit there and meditate and, like, concentrate on the infinite energy that is everywhere or something like that. Like, he basically was saying that, like, the way that most people do things is considered, you know, just nothing, like, worthless, except unless you do Kabbalah and stuff.
Right, that is their perspective. It's a very new age type thing.
So how would you learn real Kabbalah? Like, if you wanted to go into, like, very high spiritual Kabbalistic things, I mean, what's the correct road to do that? Like, if you don't go to a Kabbalah center and you're not a Chassid.
The best book on Kabbalah written in the English language is Interface by Rabbi Ari Kaplan. It's an extremely, extremely hard book to read. It's very difficult. I once listened to a book on tape, Stephen Hawking's A Brief Interview with Time, and it's like child's play compared to Interspace. It's really much easier to understand than Interspace. Interspace is a very, very difficult book, and if you want to go right to the top, that's the place to go. In the English language,
it's very hard. That's such easy stuff.
There's a lot of minute and arcane stuff you got to know. It's not so simple. So, yeah, that would be the way you would approach it from.
Real Kabbalah for beginners.
You can read his book, Meditation in the Kabbalah, that's kind of watered down. You know, that's easy reading Kabbalah.
So if we're in a bookstore and we see Kabbalah books, how do we know which one is, like, viable, real, this is real Kabbalah, real, you know, real stuff?
You have to assume that none of them are any good.
Versus fluffy stuff.
You have to assume none of them are any good.
You have to assume that?
Yeah. There was guys of Kabbalah, like Gershom Scholem and Moshe Yidel, who were believers, but viewed Kabbalah as a body of knowledge and did master some of the concepts. But our premise about Kabbalah is that if you approach it as a body of knowledge without regarding it as being holy, then you're missing the whole boat. You can't really have an understanding of Kabbalah unless you treat it as a system by which one accomplishes sanctity, not simply as a body of knowledge. The truth is, they're all sort of like that, but especially Kabbalah has to be approached in that vein, otherwise it can't be understood.
Hasidism sort of takes Kabbalah down to the common man's level.
Well, it's not exactly taking Kabbalah down to the common man's level. What Hasidism does is takes Kabbalistic concepts and makes them popularize them, but it's not the same system as Kabbalah. It's very similar, but it's not the same system as Kabbalah.
So who actually studied, like, where would you go to, like, if you're, like, older, like, if I was, like, 45 or something, and I wanted to go to yeshiva and, like,
yeshiva
really learn fine. Kabbalah, like...
The yeshiva's been fine, that's it.
Kabbalah yeshiva?
Yeah, one for Sephardim, which is called Beit El, one for Ashkenazim, which is called Shalosh Shemayim.
I missed the Beit El guys, they're not...
Which Beit El does it to me?
This is coming from Beit El.
No, no, Beit El.
It should be Kalba, kind of.
Then they're not from your Beit El. Maybe they're from Beit El in the West Bank.
No,
not Beit El. Beit El Islam is different. The real Jerusalem, the Kabbalah, Kabbalah is an institution. The thing is that, you know, Kabbalah can't be studied the same way because Gemara studies. It doesn't necessarily have to be studied like, you know, you don't have to necessarily meditate and become, you know, go up to flying through the world. There's a lot of knowledge, a lot of profound knowledge in of itself without practicing, you know, meditative techniques and stuff like that.
Study the Zohar.
You can read the Zohar and you can master it and you will still not become a practical Kabbalist. You just have another knowledge of another area of Torah.
What do you think of the English translations of the Zohar?
I
seem like a few of them.
So I don't know if they're any good.
The Kabbalah Center has one, and there's a couple others.
The Ashra Hebrew translation of the Zohar, which is considered to be a legitimate translation. Rabbi Berg Sr., who I must be a very old man by now, was a student of Rabbi Ashlag, who was a legitimate Kabbalist who lived in the shrine in the middle of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So Ashlag had translation of the Zohar is considered to be a legitimate translation.
Translation to English?
No, it's in Hebrew.
He translated from Hebrew to Hebrew?
From Aramaic.
It's Aramaic.
Oh, it's Aramaic?
Yeah.
Very good.
So Rabbi Berg Sr., or Dr. Berg, as he's called, is not considered to be a legitimate exponent of that philosophy. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Since we're having done this is an open question.
The open
question
now is public.
Why do you
seriously
feel that this book from the guy in Scranton will cause a rift in the orthodoxy? It seems like something that's orthodoxy.
There's
that philosophy already. But the people who have an agenda will accept it. Not only will they accept it, they'll advocate it. And I was told that the recent, WALU has a major sports show every year.
Yeah.
And I was told that the biggest bestseller by far and away at the WALU sports sale was Mark Shapiro's new book. So,
I don't understand why they just
make a special to asking bestseller status. Most people are not intellectually curious. But most people just buy books because they want
to... A lot of people bought Greek History of Time and never read it.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't think that's the case in why you find stuff. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe in fact I'm not going to do it. But my sense is that it is...
But the philosophy already sort of exists because if
it hadn't been intellectually based. Nobody's actually written like a Bible of that philosophy.
Right, but I mean, like, for instance, if I'm holding all the halakha things and I keep Shabbos and everything, but I don't want to believe in God, and I want to go to a place where there's Jews who accept that notion of doing what I want of halakha and not believing in God. I could just go to a reform shul somewhere. And then the reform say, do all the mitzvahs that you want if you feel that they're meaningful to you, that you don't have to believe in God. And so it seems to me that this philosophy already exists out there. I don't know why it would cause such a problem.
It's not as different. You see, there's the people who have this philosophy, or they know there is really only one legitimate form of Judaism. And they want within that legitimate form of Judaism to achieve recognition.
Absolutely.
They don't feel that they know they themselves, because they were brought up this way, because philosophically they believe this, they regard Reform Judaism and conservative Judaism as not legitimate. Right? Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is take out a position in orthodoxy, which will have intellectual legitimacy, and therefore grant them the legitimacy of orthodoxy for whatever they want to do.
That's what I'm trying to say.
But then it wouldn't be a psychological thing.
But then it wouldn't be legitimate orthodoxy.
They want to expand legitimate orthodoxy. That's their thing.
It's not legitimate anymore.
But they want to claim that it is, because they want to bring muster intellectual sources, because this is what Mark Shapiro is trying to do. Mark Shapiro is trying to go back to medieval sources mm-hmm. and demonstrate that the boundary of what's going to be orthodox is not over here, where we previously thought it was, but is way out there. And therefore, all these things speak
of the fact that children's children will still be holding the halakha.
Their
parents say, we don't believe in God, but we like doing these things.
They're not that far sighted. So the take into account what's going to happen in several generations from now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I may, the agenda of this group that you've identified, what are the things that they want to do to include them in the end of the orthodoxy? I mean, is there a top five list, a top three list?
Most of the things have to do with women's issues. And usually is where they focus their attack, so to speak. on women's issues, like, you know, women's ordination, women having their own prayer services, women's parasites. But there's also another issue, which is, it takes a long time to explain, but I once had a debate with a fellow by the name of Rabbi Dovlinzer. Rabbi Dovlinzer is the head of a yeshiva called Chovei Beit Torah. Chovei Beit Torah is a break-off from YU, the break-off from YU on the left. And the his yeshiva, together with several other institutions, small institutions, Israel and America, have an interesting philosophy and has which has two manifestations. One of them, with which I had which our debate center, is the concept of how to approach halacha, and whether you assume that a posek had personal bias in ruling the way he did. For example, the issue we debated is whether the posting who had this is his opinion as to whether you can enter a mosque or not were motivated by their halachic perspective or by their sociological perspective. Meaning that the piece that we had there was a great posting from the Ashkenazi camp said it's forbidden to enter mosques. Everybody says it's forbidden to enter churches, you know, the sanctuary of the church. Whereas whether one is allowed to enter the sanctuary of a mosque. So the piece says it's forbidden. Well, Rabbi Yosef says it's permitted. Now, the way Rabbi Linzer wants to explain this argument is that the Tzitz Eliezer is of European origin, and the Europeans equate, therefore, Islam with Christianity, and therefore, just like they forbade entering churches, they forbade entering mosques. Whereas Rabbi Yosef is of Sephardic origin, and the Sephardim lived among the Muslims, and they distinguished, therefore, between the Muslims and the Christians, and therefore, he permitted entering mosques as opposed to entering churches. In my opinion, this is preposterous. You read the response of the Tzitz Eliezer and the Rebbe of Avraham Yosef, you see quite clearly what they're based on. The Tzitz Eliezer quotes Iran. Iran is a classic Rishon. Everybody reads it up here as a major source. Iran says this is written to enter mosques. He says Islam is idolatry. Hi, it doesn't believe in the Trinity and they don't have any idols. Yes, but he says the veneration which they have for Muhammad is so great that they can claim that they don't worship him, they don't regard him as a deity. They can say that he's not a deity, but they venerate him far more than would be legitimate if they wouldn't regard him as a deity. That's what the Ron writes. So there he can't enter a mosque. That's what we have already shown the Ron who says you can't enter a mosque. Ron was a big man. He probably thought the like the Ron. Well, Rabbi Yosef says, no, not necessarily. True, the Rambam said that, but the Rambam never says this in Halacha. The Rambam says explicitly that you can't enter a church and that Christianity is Avodah Zarah, but he doesn't regard Islam as being Avodah Zarah. And therefore, even though he didn't say either way, but our assumption is since he explicitly said Christianity is Avodah Zarah and not Islam, that he would argue with the Rambam, with the Rambam. And since he would argue with the Rambam, so therefore, even though the Rambam is great, the Rambam, everybody agrees, is greater. So therefore, we pass in like the Rambam who omitted such a halacha. So really it's a very, it's a kind of dry technical argument. But from Rabbi Linzer's perspective, this is actually, there's bias involved. Now this leads to a revolutionary approach. It means that you can go back and look at the earlier authorities and decide when they were biased and when they were not and change halacha accordingly. And another example today, which I couldn't believe, but he did it, is we know there's a very big machlokes. This is the thing between the Tosfos and the Rambam as to whether women can make a bracha on mitzvahs as they shas man grama, mitzvahs which are time contingent. For example, can women make a bracha when they shake lulav? So we Ashkenazim hold they can, because we follow Rabbi Yitzchak. And the Sfaradim hold they cannot, because they follow the Rambam. Because Rabbi Yitzchak holds that when it says in the bracha, Asher ki v'shonu mitzvotot v'tzibonu, that God has sanctified us and commanded us, it doesn't necessarily refer specifically to the person who's performing the mitzvah, but a person who's Jewish people. So therefore, even though a woman is not commanded specifically to do the mitzvah, nevertheless, she can make the bracha because it refers to the totality of the Jews. Whereas the Rambam holds that the bracha, Asher Kishon Tosavet Tivonu, the sanctified and commanded must refer specifically to the person's fulfilling the mitzvah. Hmm. It doesn't refer to that person, so if the bracha of Akola, it's not a permissible bracha. But Rabbi Linder said that the difference of opinion is based on the fact that the Rabbeinu Tam was from northern European countries where they had more progressive attitudes towards women, while the Rambam was from North African countries where they had a more regressive attitude towards women. So therefore, from Rabbeinu Tam's perspective, since women are, you know, were held in higher esteem, so to speak, they were allowed to make bracha. But from Rambam's perspective, where women were held in lower esteem, they were not allowed to make bracha. What?
But their reasons are stated clearly.
Exactly. So this is like kind of like deconstructionist approach, right? You can deconstruct the posting and say, well, they might write X, Y, Z, but really what underlies their fact is A, B, C, right? Which, again, to my mind, is preposterous and it's very dangerous. So as a result, you can go back and look at any fact and say, well, he knew the bite. He doesn't say anything about the bite. Oh, we don't. So therefore, we can go back and, you know, narrowly undermine many things and change the outlook of those issues.
But it would still be fundamental that you couldn't change, but you couldn't change the bill, you couldn't change, you know, certain...
That's what you think. And that, another thing that they do, which is related to that, which I said, you know, which initially was under the basis topic, but I said, you know, you're going to lose on this topic, so we didn't decide not to do this, was their attitude of the way they learn Gemara is significantly different than the way we learn Gemara. It's directly related. When we learn Gemara, we regard the text of the Gemara as being made up of the final editing of Ravina Ravashi. According to the Gemara, what is considered to be the deliberations of the Amoraim, each of which is considered, certified by Ravina Ravashi, to be part and parcel of the chain of tradition and body of knowledge which makes up the Gemara. They don't learn that way. They try and peel back the Gemara and, again, deconstructionist. They try and find the layers in the Talmud, meaning there are certain things which were stated by certain Amoraim, which then were changed by other Amoraim, and then there is the Gemara, the stamp of the Gemara. The Gemara's flow itself, which is not attributed to any specific Amora, which is rather kind of like the connective tissue between the statements, which also is somebody else. And their perspective is that certain statements are more authoritative, because they're attributed, and certain statements are less authoritative, particularly if they're not attributed. And therefore, when they start going through Gemara, they start trying to peel away the layers and decide which layers were authentic, which layers were not authentic, which layers have more validity, which layers have less validity, which layers are really non-Jewish influence, like he wants to debate on how much of marriage will really close comes from the code of Hammurabi, and actually does is not of Jewish origin, but still produced in the Gemara, and how much of the halakhot of marriage comes from the code of Hammurabi, and are not of Jewish origin, but still go into the Gemara, and how if you peel back the layers, you are able to find that. So I said, you know, you don't want to debate that with me. And you didn't want to debate that with me. But that is, of course, also as part of this, it's not the bias issue so much as trying to create layers in text in which layers have never been clearly identified nor even, you know, ever assumed to exist.
They're trying to use modern rules of construction or something, you think.
Right, that's a very succinct way of putting it. But also it has great dangers, because then you begin to treat, you know, Talmud like not the body of law, which it actually is, or the blindly inspired law, but like any text you're using in English literature class, right? And you start treating it the same way you would treat, say Shakespeare. And then that will lead to all sorts of possibilities of manipulating the halacha and kind of identifying halacha. Well, this was stated by this, you know, this is not authoritative, this was stated in this way, by this person, this layer, and therefore it doesn't matter. It's not the ramification for the day or minute.
But wouldn't it not matter since Kolei Shraddha accepted the Gemara as that was the last thing that all Kolei Shraddha accepted as binding on them?
They don't accept that.
They don't think that...
They said it's
they don't think that you've accepted the Gemara?
It's binding, but only after you use modern academic tools to figure out what is actually Gemara.
We never had modern academic tools for thousands of years and we accepted the Gemara.
True. You have to convince me.
They don't care about that argument?
No. Yes.
So what would, you've heard of Drisha, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what is that part of their group, sort of?
Absolutely.
The guy who teaches it? Like, who are the rabbis who teach it?
All the same. Same people. There's like a coterie, is that the right word? About
deconstructionists?
Deconstructionists, about 10 or 20 deconstructionists who are populate all of these institutions together.
Some people
are the Paris Yeshiva. Well, in Paris, not everybody is Orthodox. I think in Drisha, officially everybody is Orthodox. Paris is a non-denominational institution. Drisha, at least so recently, was considered to be Orthodox. I don't know if it is anymore, but once upon a time, certainly was. Halachic based.
He's identified feminism and modern construction. Any other elements of this movement?
That's just the beginning. We don't know where it's going to end. So that was the impetus for creating a lot of these things. But eventually, we don't know how far we'll go, and obviously it has to do with whatever issues are relevant at the time. You know, knowing Orthodoxy so far has there to assert that homosexual marriage is legitimate, right?
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? You know, someday somebody might deconstruct the right text and come out with the right bias, and then, oh, this is also good, you know, and so on and so forth. So you don't know where these, who knows, this is just the beginning, and this is a movement which really only began within the last 10 years.
It's interesting because, like, my sister goes to Krishna, she said some of the people there, like, it's a very interesting situation because they're deconstructing all these halakhas and saying, oh, this is so biased against women, this is because, and that, in those days, they were so biased against women, this and that and that, and they're just, like, complaining about deconstruction, but at the end of the day, they still follow all the laws because it's a halakha. And so I said, well, why do you want to make yourself angry? Like, you're just going to make yourself more and more angry, but you're still going to do it anyway. So if you're still going to do it anyway, why don't you find ways to be happy about it rather than be angry about it?
Right, it's kind of a negligent type of approach. In other words, even though we hate it, nevertheless, we have to do it, because that's the way it is. Eventually, if you hate it enough, then you're not going to do it anymore.
Right.
So it's going to be the end. Okay, guys, give me back the sheets. Maybe someday we'll get back to this topic, especially with what we're talking about opening other people's mail.
You're trying to.